In a sense, I think, you know, the folks in machine learning, they're right in a certain way. They say we possibly have not really captured what spiking neurons are doing in the brain then. And so therefore, by just, you know, throwing spiking neurons into the model doesn't necessarily make it brain-like.
Right, sure.
Neuroscience had a much more optimistic perspective 20 years ago when we had fewer experimental data. Now that all these experiments now have shown now the simple now theories don't work, then things have become more complicated then.
This is Brain Inspired.
Santiago Ramón y Cajal, in his Advice for a Young Investigator, writes of theorists that their, quote, symptoms include a facility for exposition, a creative and restless imagination, an aversion to the laboratory, and an indomitable dislike for concrete science and seemingly unimportant data. They claim to view things on a grand scale. They live in the clouds. He goes on at length and then later writes, quote, basically, the theorist is a lazy person masquerading as a diligent one, end quote. Ramón y Cajal was using theorist there to refer to one prototype of someone who is creative and has a lot of potential, but doesn't do what it takes to accomplish anything. Well, we here at Brain Inspired, that would be me, know that theory is, of course, an essential part of scientific progress. But as my guest again today, Wolfgang Maas, knows, experiments are also essential to close the loop of that scientific progress. So we're at this weird stage to me, it's weird, in neural network and deep learning development, where we've seen a ton of success in terms of what deep nets can do, and a ton of development in terms of the varieties of neural networks being built. And there's a lot of excitement in neuroscience because deep networks seem to account for how our brains process signals better than models in the past, in general, have accounted for our brains. But there are people like Wolfgang who believe that there's lots more to learn about computation if we consider more details and principles that underlie how brains operate. Things we learn from experiments, like trial-to-trial variability in the spiking patterns of neurons, the stochastic nature of spiking itself, and so on. So in this second part of my talk with Wolfgang, we step through a few of those promising avenues for incorporating experimental findings into models of spiking networks, and we sprint through a few of his latest projects implementing some of these principles. But you should check out his work in more detail. I wanted to talk at greater length about his latest work, but we just ran out of time. So go check out the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/59 to learn more about that work. I have a lot of great guests lined up, and thanks to those of you who are emailing me. Thank you if you're emailing me with kind words of appreciation. That, along with monetary support on Patreon, really do let me know that I'm headed in the right direction. But I also enjoy your emails with requests for various guests. I have a long list of people to invite, but when I hear from you guys and you suggest someone, it either puts them on my radar or on my list, if they're not already on there. But usually, it's someone who is already on my list, but your email serves to basically bump them closer to the top of that list. So if you want to hear someone on the show, do get in touch. Just email paul@braininspired.co. Happy theorizing and experimenting out there. I'll see you next time. Let's start getting into some of what you do really more. So spiking neural networks, this is like your bread and butter here. And you've called spiking neural networks the third generation of artificial neural networks. You want to just kind of walk through really high level, like what are the first two generations and how do they differ from spiking nets?
Yeah, this is something I wrote a long time ago. Remember correctly, the first generation were just the threshold circuits, which I mentioned now, which were at the same time my Kullach-Pitts neurons, so the earliest models for the function of neurons in the brain, and also they were considered in computer science and computational complexity theory. And there's characteristic that you have neural models which give a binary output, zero or one then. And then one noticed that it's very hard to train these networks at that time. And so therefore they went to neurons which give an analog output number, so sigmoidal neurons, so where they give a smooth output, which is a nonlinear way, kind of proportional to the input.
And this is what has driven us all the way up through current day in deep learning networks. Yeah.
Right, differentiable. Although kind of aspect of history is since a few years one knows also really how to apply powerful learning principles to threshold circuits or spiking neurons.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out it's a very simple kind of hack, works amazingly well. You simply pretend and this Heaviside function is differentiable and simply postulate the derivative of this.
So you replace the spike with sort of a smooth function, right?
Yeah, or simply plug in for the non-existing derivative, something which goes up and goes down then in a smooth manner.
Yeah.
And this is mathematically awful, right? But practically, it's the most powerful method for really training now at the moment also networks of spike neurons, and it works really so much better than previously considered learning methods, at least if one wants to really train a whole network. If you don't just want to kind of train a single connection between two neurons, then...
And you can do that using backpropagation.
Right. Now, so in principle, one can therefore use versions of backpropagation through time then. And it's amazing how well this works then. And one can watch it now. We apply it to the spiking neural networks for the same task as then a model for differentiable neurons, which is used in machine learning, like networks of LSTM units, and then simply compare the performance then. And typically the spiking version is a few percent off, which may be due to this defect in the training then, or for other reasons, but they're in the same ballpark then.
Yeah. So brains are efficient. Deep learning networks, the ones that use the gradient responses, the analog signals, are extremely inefficient. Is efficiency the main reason to start to figure out how to use spiking neural networks, or is there something about the computational principles from spiking and from brains that deep networks won't ever be able to capture?
Yeah, I find it difficult to say something which says deep learning networks will never capture this, because previously these things turned out to be wrong. But there are certain characteristic differences, and I think it's not only spiking neurons, but the fact that neurons in the brain of different types, you have excitatory and inhibitory neurons, even you have different classes of inhibitory neurons, which well-defined paraneural connectivity profiles and probably also functions. And this is something we don't have in deep learning networks. And this is at least as fundamental as spiking versus non-spiking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, for example, this fact that you have inhibitory neurons, and articles in neuroscience proposed actually that one should typically think of brain networks. When you have pyramidal cells, it's under an inhibitory lock then. Only if there is a certain release for a short time window, because just the things are right at the moment for various reasons, the network allows this neuron to fire.
So the network is always at the ready and ready to go, and it's only until it's released. And once it's released by the inhibition, so it's disinhibited, then it can enact the performance.
Right. And it's really sparsely disinhibited, and so therefore it's sparsely active. And this may contribute really to its also energy efficiency, because if you have a generic artificial neural network, most of the neurons are more or less active all the time, then, whereas in the brain, most of the neurons are not active.
Right.
And if a neuron is active, it says something, it has a meaning then. And probably this is could even be a coding principle that, you know, the individual neuron in the brain has, you know, as its individual, has more of a meaning than a neuron in an artificial neural network, which is always, you know, a voice in a crowd then.
Let's get into this. So you wrote a review in Current Opinions of Behavioral Sciences called Searching for Principles of Brain Computation, and you lay out you suggest multiple features of brain networks and neurons that you think can provide clues to how they compute and learn. And we've just talked about two. Spiking is one of them, and spiking neural networks. And you just talked about the sparsity, and I guess we talked about more than two. Sparsity and... Go ahead.
But actually, these two were not even mentioned among these four things which they addressed then.
Yeah. So you've mentioned more in talks as well. So yeah. I just kind of wanted to walk through some and just kind of explain, get your comments on them.
Yeah. So this also, I think it goes to me really coming back to the way how I think, you know, a theoretician in this area, you know, should really do science. You know, they should watch out for solid experimental data which really are in contradiction to common theoretical assumptions then.
How does that contrast with the way that they a theoretician would normally go about? I mean, are they sitting in their church and that's how they get their ideas?
Well, you read, you know, papers by typically from your community then. Mm-hmm. You know, there, of course, you know, now fortunately also, there are not quite a number of research labs where people, you know, look into the other field. No, I don't want to, you know, sure. And a, you know, too negative feature.
Sure.
I want to see it more positive. I want to encourage people in theory, you know, to look more at experiments. But I think, you know, that, for example, people who do work on, say, predictive coding, typically when I talk to people, or at least the people to whom I talk, I didn't find that they really searched the literature for experimental evidence for or against this hypothesis.
Yeah.
And so this is somewhat, you know, it's a gulf, of course, between experimental, you know, kind of style papers and theoretical papers. And it's usually not required then from republishing a theoretical paper that you really go down into the experimental literature and, you know, discuss the validity of your assumptions, you know, in the light of this experimental data then.
Well, there's a lot of data out there.
Yeah. So you have to select it. So, for example, therefore, in this, you know, review article that I mentioned, I looked at four principles which really go against basic assumptions of, you know, larger portions of theoretical models. The first one was this heterogeneity of neurons then.
Yeah.
And it goes even beyond, you know, having excitator and inhibitor neurons. If you take a closer look, that it's hard to say that you find any two neurons which respond in exactly the same way to the same stimuli. This is what experimental neuroscientists told me. And the same actually holds for synapses then.
Yeah.
If you apply the same protocol, pairing protocol, to two synapses, typically you find no different outcomes there, right? And when one finds this distribution of data points clearly in all these SDP papers, but people ignore these data points and they just look at this interpolating curves, which have a nice exponential shape, and then derive, you know, SDP rules from this averaging over lots of different synapses.
Sure.
But if you would then apply theory or in a model where you have this diversity of synapses, then probably, you know, it wouldn't produce, you know, the outcome that you would like to see out of this. So therefore, I think there's simply a fundamental principle, you know, in place then that one should not think, you know, that brain networks in the brain really, you know, are just, you know, architectures of a single, of a very small number of building blocks. Then there's an almost infinite diversity of emergent local modules then. And so therefore, also from the theoretical perspectives, we have to really move towards a formalism which allows us to study dynamical systems which consist out of such heterogeneous adapting units then.
One approach to this is liquid computing, which you developed almost 20 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe I can just ask you, like, what the, well, liquid computing, I guess, celebrates the diversity of all sorts of types of neurons in principle and all sorts of types of synapses, because in essence, it's this just mass of recurrently connected units that you just send input in, and because of all their diversity, they come up with all sorts of different subfunctions that then you can output this mass of units to these readout neurons and just train the readout neurons of how to interpret all these subfunctions and put them together to train them to do what you want. That's probably an insufficient description of liquid computing. Maybe you can add a better description.
Yeah. Liquid computing came really about out of meeting with Henry Markram, who is an experimental neuroscientist, one of the most talented experimental neuroscientists in recording with patch claim for many neurons, and simply one of the discoverers of SEDP. And he deeply cares about really what is the computation organization of a cortical column. And at that time, there were two kind of dominant schools of thinking. One was a tractor neural network model, that the whole network moves into a tractor, and then this produces the answer. The other one was more the ice cube model, more oriented towards coding in visual cortex, Hubel and Wiesel, that you have a whole column, and all the neurons in this column have the same role they're supposed to fire when a certain orientation shows up then.
Right.
And then you have the next column where all the neurons there do some other things. And both of these hypotheses are not really consistent with experimental data as far as I know. And so therefore, Henry said, everything flows then, like Heraclitus then, right? And he wanted to see how you can still do meaningful computation within this seemingly uncontrollable diversity of local dynamical units then. Mm-hmm. And so then liquid computing was simply one way of getting sense and use out of such a system there by just keeping in mind that there are certain readouts which are certain neurons, maybe in other areas, which have a particular task and a particular goal to extract particular information. And there it's good simply to multiplex lots of information. You can superimpose it in such a liquid then, and then still individual readout neurons can tease it out. And so I think it's still an interesting paradigm. I think one aspect where I now think differently is that in that model, all the plasticity was really postulated to take place in the readout neurons then. Whereas in this recurrent circuits, we didn't need even plasticity. And this is something which is probably biologically wrong then, right? There's plasticity everywhere. And so at that time, I think this was simply a convenience because we didn't have any theoretical or algorithmic tools to understand learning in recurrent networks of diverse elements. And so now, since a few years, we do have, for example, EPROP, a method which is even biologically plausible and which allows you to understand learning, not only supervised learning, but also reward-based learning in recurrent networks. And one sees that really they can gain a much higher level of functionality.
Yeah.
So nowadays, I think actual circuits are somewhere in between. To some extent, also the recurrent circuitry itself is already pre-configured to maybe facilitate the role of common subsequent readouts. But it still has a certain general purpose aspect in order to allow new readouts when you want to learn a new task then and you need to extract new features from your input, that still is feasible because the recurrent circuitry, say in a cortical column, isn't completely already dedicated to one function then.
Is one of the lessons there that it actually is beneficial to have maximally diverse types of neurons and types of synapses to maximize the number of different computations that could be performed with the same pool of neurons?
That's correct. And this is one of the few cases where I saw then really a use for having diversity then. And there even was some theory going along with this from approximation theory, but it was not really at that tight level. That's a theoretical explanation. But I think we do need more kind of theoretical frameworks which allow us to really approach an understanding of diversity of dynamical system, which consists of diverse elements. And I think what's somewhat against this is simply a certain kind of tradition in our thinking, which is probably influenced by theoretical physics there, where you think now of statistical physics. Now you have certain molecules of a gas, they're all the same, and you get really exciting global phenomena in terms of interaction of the same units then.
Yeah.
And I think this paradigm really is in the back of heads of many neuroscientists also. And I think probably biological tissue is really not suitable for these models which come from theoretical physics. But it's very hard to depart from such a well-established track of thinking and concepts.
Yeah,
And you really have to set out to really make a conscious effort to move the science into a somewhat different direction, to really get an understanding of dynamical system, way of heterogeneous adaptive components then. Yeah. And this is exactly, I think, the type of theory that we are missing at the moment, to really have an analytical counterpart for understanding complex experimental data.
Well, like you said, it's sort of easy if all the units are the same, you can mentally kind of chunk them into a space in your mind and then start manipulating them in your head and how they could interact. But all of a sudden you throw diversity of units and diversity of synapses and it just gets really messy and it's really hard to keep track of.
Yeah. So this, I started out with the first one of this kind of stumbling blocks from experimental science that are listed in my review article. The second was that neurons don't behave the way as we expect them also from theory, that they somehow look for finding a role on their own, finding a role in the network to make themselves useful. They tend to gang up into so-called assemblies or assembly sequences. And there's rich literature which started a little bit in the Buzhaki lab, but it really went out into all areas of neocortex, that everywhere where you look, you find that neurons don't really act on their own. There are coalitions of them then. And these are somehow loose coalitions, but one really should not think of a neural circuit really of being just a set of individual neurons which all do their own thing then. They have certain group phenomena.
Modularity.
Right. But it's a difficult one because these are not clear-cut groups, like in the ice cube models.
Right.
These are kind of ensembles, and I think this is very nicely described by Buzhaki also in his review paper in Neuron, I think about 2010, where he said, at each moment a neuron decides whether it wants to join an assembly or not then. Mm. And this may actually be possibly something really fundamental to the way in how brains work, because we don't just do sensory processing. We always have goals in mind. We have memory in our mind, we have preconceived hypotheses, and this all colors our sensory information, our processing all the time then. And I think one could possibly view this as being kind of more the system level consequence of having the somewhat loose assemblies then.
Hmm.
Where one should think of a hardcore of an assembly as something which really corresponds to an hardcore of a concept then. And then there are these fringes then, which provide a rich meaning, which really is less reliable. It really depends on your recent history and other goals or so.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I think and this is something actually which is at the center of this new book by Buzhaki, The Brain from Inside Out, because he postulates there an exciting hypothesis that these assemblies are there already in the brain from the beginning, say.
In the structure?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is something which has some support, then you find activity patterns even developing tissue. And then he thinks the issue of neural coding is really that these assemblies have to find some meaning in the outside world to which they then relate then. So
okay.
That you first have a certain organization of kind of, say, potential concepts which are still empty, possibly relating to motor outputs, and then you relate them to meaning in the outside world, to events, to sensory information then.
So this is like imprinting in a duck. A duck comes out and it has a It has an assembly that's just like, mom, 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 and it's waiting. And then it sees the lamppost and thinks, oh, that's mom. Okay.
This is a perfect example then, right? And I think it's quite exciting because it really now really requires a new way of thinking about really how neural coding happens, you know, what really happens during learning then. Mm-hmm. And they also know, I would recommend, if anybody who's interested, look for example at the work of Ken Harris at UCL London, or Jason McLean at University of Chicago, who have studied now various aspects of these assemblies. And for a theoretician, this is, as far as I can see, still an enigma then. We tried now to get now hold of this now organization in summer. Yeah, creating a theory of computing with assemblies, then also now partially together with now well-known computer scientist Christos Papadimitriou at Columbia University. But at the moment, I think now the reality of the assemblies in the brain escape us. Now, we don't have a conceptual or analytical framework which is flexible enough to fit now to the complex data then. Mm-hmm. But I think it's something that, yeah, we may have to grope for really a formalism then. It may not really fit to any existing way of formalizing things then. But now coming back to my four no observations, no kind of no facts which I took from as lessons for experimental neuroscience, this is certainly something which should occupy many theoreticians and modelers, because this is likely to be really also very rewarding, because we know from recording from human brain, also epileptic patients, that concepts are intimately linked to assemblies. Then basically, evoking a concept is like really activating an assembly. And then also, a few years ago, it was shown that if you form an association between concepts, like you see a person in front of a background for the first time, you see even how these two assemblies in the brain change then. So we even have now evidence how assemblies are modified in order to accommodate associations between different tokens of meaning then. So we have really wonderful evidence then now which links now this activity on the level of neurons to really, really high level cognitive operations then, but more work needs to be done then.
The theory's not there, yeah.
And I think now for me the exact frontier is now we have now published a paper in cerebral cortex where we in principle, try to model this process of the formation of associations then using STP, and it works then also. But also what we found, it's very hard to create a model which scales up then, because in the brain you have thousands of different concepts and assemblies, yeah, probably tens of thousands, and they're quite selectively associated and not associated. And at the moment, I'm missing really a modeling framework which allows us to create such a large set of assemblies which don't interfere with each other in unwanted ways, but are kind of ready to be associated whenever this arises then. So therefore, I think that this is really a wonderful area to work on. And I find it unfortunate that very few theoreticians are working on this problem.
I mean, there's so many things that you work on that so many people could join in and contribute to as well. I mean, it's super impressive just the scope of the directions that you're taking from the theoretical perspective using these biological constraints. So there are plenty more of these biological constraints that you mentioned in the paper and then beyond. Maybe we should keep walking through them.
Yeah, I think the third one is also really exciting for theoreticians. This is the fact now that neurons are not deterministic as far as we know then. And this is apparently really built into the way how neurons are built. The spiking mechanism around the soma and axon is quite deterministic, as many people have shown. But synaptic release is probabilistic, as we know, and probably also dendritic spikes to some extent stochastic there.
Yeah, with a probability varying between some estimates of really low to about by chance.
Right. And this I find intriguing, right? Because if we want to build a model and we believe synaptic weights are important and synaptic connections are important because they hold the learned information, yeah, you wouldn't make them so unreliable, right?
Yeah.
So therefore, I think now this may really inform us, because the brain really wants to optimize something else and really has a different architectural paradigm in mind now than we have when we build neural networks.
So the stochasticity issue, I mean, you've done work on what it could be good for, right? So one of the things is probabilistic inference, and we don't need to go into detail about these things. But this could be how state transitions are computed by sampling. And I had Mate Lingyel on the show, and he's worked a lot on calculating, computing probabilistic inference using sampling from stochastic populations of neurons. You know, so they're stochastically firing X potentials. And also that means from trial to trial, the variability in their spiking is high. There's high trial to trial variability. Another problem that you have seen, a benefit to computation of this stochasticity, is the potential to solve constraint satisfaction problems in a heuristic manner. I don't know if you want to just comment on that.
Yeah, I think that this is still an exciting area, and it points to me towards an aspect of understanding stochastic activity in brain circuits, which I don't understand yet, because in order to do to solve in a stochastic manner constraint satisfaction problem, you simply know you go stochastically through many possible solutions until you find a solution that you find satisfactory. And now this second part is really difficult, and I don't see any hints from biology how this is implemented, because you not only have to generate stochastically possible solutions to the problem, you need to then have a very effective and also very fast, probably, evaluation circuitry.
Which one's right?
Which says, This is now completely crap. This could be good, but I will put it, into memory and look for still something better.
And how long do I need to look until I say, okay, fine, I'll do that.
Yep. And so this is something that we are missing. I think we're also missing really also information about what is the speed of the sampling then, because if it's happening at the speed of, say, single spikes, so that you have every 20 or 40 milliseconds another sample, that's extremely fast sampling. And this makes, of course, even harder for any evaluation circuitry to look at the quality of any current proposed solution then, right?
That's got to be unlikely, right?
Yeah. So probably the brain uses some slower sampling, and the best evidence that I found there is really work of Wallis from UC Berkeley a few years ago, which was an orbital frontal cortex where monkeys had to evaluate which of different liquid rewards they probably would like more. And he found that before they made the selection, he found that in orbital frontal cortex, he had certain characteristic state switches then, and they were on a slower time scale, I think more of hundreds of milliseconds. So this would be a kind of a stochastic search, which would better fit into the speed of really cognitive processing and evaluation circuitry. But then we have problems to really implement this slow sampling of the level of neurons and synapses then. So this is probably the reason is because our standard models of neurons and synapses are really lacking in this intermediate time scales. They're made to model the spiking process and postsynaptic potentials, so at tens of milliseconds, but they're not good in really reflecting what neurons and synapses can do on this intermediate time scale of hundreds of milliseconds and going to seconds. This is not in the scope of the models. One knows these time scales exist. Calcium concentrations or autophosphorylated CAMK2 or various processes in synapses, metabotropic synapses, which have slow processes. Now we know this exists, but I'm missing quantitative models which allow us to put them into models.
Put them into use.
And put them together with a network function then on this intermediate time scale. And this, I think, is really a major deficiency then. And possibly there they would be fruitful if theoreticians and experimentalists would come together, because I hear from many neuroscientists that they know about this, but apparently they're also a little bit frustrated, because if they tell their colleagues from theory about this, they're not so interested, because this doesn't fit into usual frameworks, right? And they can't even model this. And they even have trouble, for example, to find a reasonable good model for midapotropic synapses and all the signals which affect it then. So this can be solved properly, right? Now, if one just puts the mind to it then, and I think this is something we need then.
Well, yeah, maybe let's get through a few more, and then I kind of want to ask high-level questions about the just these constraints and constraints in general.
Yeah. So there was only the last constraint then in this review paper, which is this well-observed fact that a neural circuitry is not really fixed. And so
never.
This came from pulsome imaging of spines. Once one were able to monitor them for hours and days, one sees the many connections that come and go then. And so therefore, it appears to be that it's probably the wrong mindset to think that there's a genetically encoded circuitry, which is just very good in supporting many computation functions, many adaptive functions. But even the architecture of circuitry adapts to the set of tasks at hand then.
Mm-hmm.
And there were nice quantitative models. And then one can even view this. Now one can put then also stochasticity into synaptic plasticity rules, and then one can view also network adaptation as a sampling process, but now on a slower time scale, on the time scale of connections that come and go then.
Mm-hmm.
And so one can view this as a network really, searching really for configuration which works well then. And so this was again something coming back to favorite beliefs in neuroscience. Now, in neuroscience, typically you have a model where the connections are fixed then, right? No, you don't change them. And I think this is probably not the way how brain circuits act.
Well, you don't change them until you need to learn something, right?
But
we know that there's spontaneous pruning of synapses and growth of synapses and that they're constantly changing over time. And it's a miracle. I don't know. I'll use the word miracle. We're talking about churches, so I'll use the word miracle. That there is stable computational function given this dynamic process of synapses constantly changing, and their stochasticity, and the diversity of types. I mean, it's just amazing that there is. How can there be computational stability in that regime?
Yeah, I think this. In principle, now my take-home message is from the modeling and theory that we did on this a few years ago is that in principle, now even local synaptic plasticity rules or stochastic plasticity rules are in principle able to maintain the system level robustness and stability and always move the system towards something that works better, at least stochastically than. Mm. But then the open question is, these are now particular plasticity rules, which have now a certain stochastic term. And I don't know how close they are to the actual plasticity of synapses then, right?
Right, right?
So in the next step, we would have to go back then to synaptic plasticity and analyze it, say from the perspective of this theory to see to what extent it fits then.
Mm.
And I find it unfortunate. Apparently, synaptic plasticity research is not so popular anymore in experimental neuroscience. Maybe it's just too difficult. And many neuroscientists also see that everybody wants to see SDP and they can't produce it in their data.
Right, right.
Different wrinkles, right, which don't fit theories. So this is, again, a missed opportunity to bring these two communities together then, to have open-minded theoreticians who really out... for understanding what are these plasticity rules in different specific types of neurons, particular context, and neuroscientists who have now new tools to really know to answer some of these questions then through the experiments.
See, what you don't understand, Wolfgang, is that we've got plasticity figured out. There needs to be no more experimentation on it. You see, but I mean that is an interesting thing. So plasticity is the standard story of learning. And there are different types, spike timing dependent plasticity, long-term potentiation, long-term depression. What do you think the legacy is going to be of plasticity and our current understanding of it in how it functions, what it does in brains? Do you think we have it all wrong or just an extremely incomplete picture of how it's working in brains and therefore how we can even really theorize about how it might work?
Mm. Yeah, I think we have some bits of truth then, but we extrapolate it too much then. And I think we know, besides STP, actually there's wonderful work which was done now, I think about 15 years ago, about synaptic plasticity on dendrites. And there are different rules in place there. It doesn't need a postsynaptic spike. And it actually, this exhibits fast plasticity. Mm. And this is something which is really postulated in most models then, but it's not something which STP can provide according to any of the data. If you look at, for example, this really thorough experiments of Frumke in New York, who had now published a paper about this temporal aspects, that typically a synapse needs at least 50 to 100 pairings, really, to move into direction you want to move it. And so this doesn't fit together with we learn a new fact then, and it's now in our brain.
Learning. Yeah.
So this doesn't fit together all together then. So I think there are different types of plasticity, and I think dendrites seem to play a role there. I think what bothers me is also we know so little about consolidation. We think if you don't reflect about it, that consolidation is somewhat a very simple and boring process where, for example, the most recent or the most important information is kept and the other one is forgotten. But there's evidence, and it was pointed out by Stigold and Walker some years ago, also in a very nice review paper, I think it was called the memory triage, that consolidation appears to be really a very intelligent process, where a new fact is scrutinized from the perspective to what extent does it fit into already known schemes, mm-hmm. whether it completely contradicts it or it completely fits into this. So therefore, it's really something where new knowledge is really compared with existing knowledge. And it's then the decision about this new knowledge is done in a way which builds a useful data structure there.
Within the context of existing knowledge, is that why as we age, we become resistant to considering novel perspectives?
I don't know. Yeah. I didn't encounter this yet. I think it's a cultural aspect probably.
Oh, probably so. And you're young at heart and in that culture. So,
yeah. But this is, I think, something which is really is missing, and I think it's a very difficult question because it probably goes deep into molecular biology, right? Into epigenetics. Then we know something about the signal cascades. Then I haven't seen any quantitative rules about the timing, and I think any theory about learning in a model for brain circuits without consolidation is probably something it's only half of a model then, because the brain does use consolidation in a strong way then. And I think there we are missing this. I think it had been approached in recent years with some interesting papers, but they looked at the problem of consolidation only from the perspective of avoiding catastrophic forgetting. And this is, for me, a little bit too isolated or possibly even contrived functional aspect then.
Okay.
Now, as I indicated before, the evidence from cognitive science is that consolidation does something much more intelligent than just avoiding that your memory overflows then.
Right.
And I think we need to formulate precisely what we need and then again bring theoreticians who ask these questions together with experimentalists who are able to bring evidence from the experimental side.
I mean, consolidation too is one of the beautiful functions for it. It's known that all of us have the capability of near infinite memory, and half of the job is just getting the memory out, right? Retrieving the memory, right? So if it's well consolidated, it might be easily retrieved as well. So
I think it's a very good point. As we know, I think what one says about autistic people, right? They have, some of them have an infinite memory, but they have the problem really of really fitting this new content into the context of the old content. Exactly this intelligent part of consolidation is apparently not working so well then. But as you point out, just putting new information, new items into memory does not appear to be a problem really for brains then, right?
Yeah.
They really want to create meaningful data structures in the brain, not just pieces of items.
So we just stepped through a bunch of biological features that you think are important to think about for how computation can work in this regime. And not only are they important, but you take these constraints, and this is a thread that you are just is just constant throughout your work. You take these constraints and you approach it thinking about how they could actually benefit computation. What we think of as constraints could potentially benefit computation, right? And we just listed these, like the how could variability benefit it? How could stochasticity? How could, you know, the plasticity, et cetera? What I'm wondering is, are there constraints that are detrimental? Or will we always find a constraint and think, how can that benefit computation? And will there always be a benefit to computation? Or can we just throw some away? Are there some that just aren't going to help us, that are actually unhelpful?
Yeah, I think I'm not aware of this. But this may also really say something about really the rich reservoir of theories, right? You have a theory for everything then.
Yeah.
You just have to change your tool somewhat, and then you have a new constraint.
Right.
And you do find a theory which fits to this. So it's just mathematics now is just so rich, then it's very hard to come up with a scenario where just Shearson says, I don't have any theory really to apply there.
Yeah.
Although altogether there, I say, we're struggling, then I think we're missing a theoretical approach for understanding dynamical systems, which consist of heterogeneous components, which have their own dynamics on different time scales. So this is really something which is a big stumbling block, and it's right in the middle of this research there.
Okay, so Wolfgang, we're running up against time, and I wanted to go through three of your more recent papers. Let me just list them off, and then I want you to sort of choose what road we go down for just a few minutes. So one of the things that you've recently done is, so recurrent neural networks have come on the scene. They're very powerful because they have recurrent connections like the brain. So they can use previous information moving forward in computing things moving forward, a memory, essentially. And then along came long short-term memory, LSTMs, which can hold on to memories for longer and are, they had this read-write capability, which is trained in them. It's not actually programmed in them. And one of the things that you've recently done is you have created a spiking neural network version of LSTM using biological properties known, that is adaptation in neurons. So that's one thing that we could talk about. You've also done a lot of work on this learning to learn or meta-learning, meta-reinforcement learning framework, and all of these are, really related. And then another one, which you may want to talk about, because you mentioned it earlier, which is EPROP, and this is using biological constraints to basically replace backpropagation through time in spiking neural networks and implement a biologically plausible way for spiking neural networks to learn that has been really powerful and has you've been able to train neural networks, spiking networks, basically to the same capabilities as their cousins, as their backpropagation through time cousins. Let's see and the last thing was just using, we talked about liquid computing earlier, and you've used reservoirs. It's also called reservoir computing. Liquid computing is one type of reservoir computing. And you've used this reservoir computing regime in the meta-learning framework as well, the learning-to-learn framework as well. What do you want to talk about before we wrap up here?
Yeah, maybe I say something briefly about each of them. So just one or two sentences.
Great.
And I first want to say this is actually not my work, but it's the work of our group then. And we have wonderful young researchers. And I think also there are researchers which are theoreticians, computer scientists, and they know quite a bit of neuroscience. And I think we need more of these junior researchers who have this multiple competence and interest in truly to make progress. So the first for many years in the context of spike neural networks, we were looking for something which has similar function as this strange LSTM units in artificial neural networks. And it turned out, if you just throw into model basically any kind of slow process which you want to, and we just took spike rate adaptation as a kind of very handy and well-documented process which seems to take place on the right timescale, namely on the timescale of seconds. If you just put it into the model, then these networks do acquire a functionality which comes very close in simulations to LSTM networks, even for speech processing or hardener benchmark tasks. And so for me, it's just a lesson in really now looking at the functionality of slow processes. So this is, I think, just the starting point for this then. But also there's another kind of lesson behind it. It doesn't work if you construct networks now with adapting neurons, then this only works if you have sufficiently capable network learning algorithm then. And you can use SpecProp through time just to make it work in the model. But now more satisfactory would be not to have now more biological possible algorithm. And EPROP is one proposition that we made now in this year, which seems to have these properties. I don't want to say, no, it's proven that this is biologically realistic, but at the moment we don't see a concrete aspect of it where one can definitely say, no, this can't happen in neural circuits. So again, it's a proposition for experimentalists, you know, to falsify this then. But at the moment we are happy, and also actually, you know, people who build spiking hardware are happy because in contrast to backpropagation through time, EPROP is an online learning method and therefore can be implemented on the chip then. And so this is happening right now in one company and one university lab. You know, they're implementing EPROP on their chips, and this will probably become the most powerful on-chip learning method for recurrent networks.
Well, and I just want to interject because EPROP combines this an eligibility trace, this biological property of a fading memory in synapses, with also a top-down learning signal, which can be equated with things like dopamine neurotransmitters in brains. So it's beautiful work, and I wish we had more time to go into it. But so it's going to dominate neuromorphic chips, huh?
Well, we've seen, I don't want to be modest, but I think for recurrent networks of spiking neurons, we don't have much else than. I think now here now we see we don't get quite now to the level of what can be done with backpropagation through time, but I'm very happy, for example, now one of our guys now, Franz Scher, showed that you can even a network of spiking neurons can learn to win Atari games then. So this type of benchmark task was really now used to be deep in the home turf of deep learning people now in industry at DeepMind. And now we have a spike neural networks who learns this without any human supervision, just from rewards now, from making points within the game then. So I think it's very nice now that we no longer have a gulf in the type of task we consider in models for brain circuits and their learning and the type of task which are tackled in artificial intelligence. And so I think it's very nice now that we can partially start to talk about the same problems and then compare solutions then and see, you know, to what extent they inspire each other then. Mm-hmm. And the last word on meta-learning, this is something also which I think came really from machine learning then. Now, it was started, I think, by Sepp Hochreiter, and it also has a root in neuroscience no longer ago then, which is simply the observation that we're doing something wrong when we model learning typically, because we take off the shelf a certain network and then we expose it to a certain learning problem then. And no network in the brain is ever in the situation then, right? And so this simply takes us into account that there's a priming, probably very sophisticated priming, you know, through evolution, through development, through prior learning then. And I think, you know, these methods allow us to, at least on a functional level, to go through some of these processes and in this way to get a better understanding. And I think what I find most exciting about this, we find in this way you can also get the capability of abstraction into neural network models then, that they don't always work on the level of immediate sensory inputs and the pixel level, as one says in machine learning, but they can more work on the level of abstractions, relation between objects or other kind of abstract reasoning. And I think this is something which is going to happen in the next 2 years, that we see how models of spiking neurons can do reasoning, abstract reasoning also. And so this is something that I always wanted to do. I wanted to see how a model for network of spiking neurons starts to think. And I think this becomes possible within the next few years.
Oh, that's a great place to end it. Quickly, though, you know, so you are really engrossed in these spiking neural networks. What's your take on how deep learning folks think about spiking neural networks? I know the neuromorphics people love it, but do deep learning practitioners care about spikes?
Not so much then. I think the main reason why it's also of interest, you know, from the perspective of deep learning or industries, that, you know, possibly spike-based implementation of deep learning can be implemented in a more energy-efficient way then.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is still not something where the answer is out. You know, there are many, you know, I think there are over 40 startup companies working on this problem, building energy-efficient hardware for AI, and we have to see whether spiking works or not. But in a sense, I think, you know, the folks in machine learning, they're right in a certain way. They say, we possibly have not really captured what spike neurons are doing in the brain then. And so therefore, by just, you know, throwing spike neurons into the model doesn't necessarily make it brain-like.
Right, sure.
And my reading of this is, you know, that, you know, sure, no, because we're missing so many aspects of biological neurons which are not in traditional spike neuron models, like, you know, all these intermediate slow processes, right? And so therefore, these are so far not so genuinely kind of more complex or more resourceful models then. And so therefore, I think, you know, they're right then. But it could be, you know, also that, you know, it happens more in more complex work on deep learning then. But at the moment, no, I think they're right now of ignoring it.
Huh. What is something that you used to believe that you now consider naive?
Being a skeptic, I can't really see something then, just because
you've
I don't
always been a skeptic.
Many things then. I'm very skeptical about things, and I don't believe so many things per se then.
Ah.
And in a sense, I think the skepticism itself now has been proven wrong then. So I like it very much. You know, one of the most famous, you know, neuroscientists, you know, in Europe, you know, Wolf Singer from Frankfurt, says in his talk sometimes he thought, you know, that neuroscience had a much more optimistic perspective 20 years ago when we had fewer experimental data. Now that all these experiments, you know, have shown, you know, this simple, you know, theories don't work, then things have become more complicated then. And I think this tended to be always, you know, my approach from the beginning then. And so therefore, I'm not so surprised by this effect.
Yeah.
And I think altogether, if you want to think about, you know, the benefit of the field, you know, of this kind of, you know, also tentative growing together of neuroscience and, you know, machine learning and AI on the other side, I think what is really is needed more workshops where we ask questions which are cross-cutting of the type that you have raised then. And I think as soon as people from either side have an opportunity simply to become familiar with this, you know, main concept and result from the other side, you know, they love it then, right? So it's really, the problem is, you know, to create enough opportunities of this type then. And it's not so easy because, for example, you know, if somebody says, you know, yeah, well, from computer science, I want to read up on neuroscience, you know, what should I read?
Yeah.
I don't have an easy answer, and the same hope, yeah, for the other way, right? So we need, you know, somehow to create at least a temporary curriculum and really work on this, you know, identify or encourage, you know, students to try to understand, you know, both of these fields then, and then create bridges for them, which make it easier for them, you know, to cross these gulfs between these areas.
I love it, Wolfgang. Thank you so much for your time. I kept you very late, but and I would love to keep you all day, so I'm sorry that we can't, but I appreciate you being here. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul, very much. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Brain Inspired is a production of me and you. You can support the show through Patreon for a microscopic $2 or $4 per month. Go to braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help sustain and improve the show and prohibit any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thanks for your support. See you next time. Man.